My name is Shlomo Shapiro. I'm a consultant at ProBusiness Berlin, which is an ISV in Germany. And I'm here to present you an idea and also the solution of the simple high available Linux file server. You may ask any question at any moment, but there will be also time for questions and answers at the end. And please don't be disappointed. This solution is simple. The focus is on simple. It works very simple. And it's not a cluster, but it's simple and it's very high available. Short agenda. I will give you some background information about the whole story and the project. I will give you also the possible solutions that were considered before defining the simple high available Linux file server. And of course, I will explain you why that solution really is the best. The customer is a public state agency in Potsdam, which is near my office, luckily. They are heavily IT dependent because they're in the business of making maps, the state mandated official maps of the federal state of Brandenburg. And they have quite a lot of IT. For instance, they run 3 EVAs with, I think, more than 40 terabyte and run well over 100 servers to do all that business. And they transport a lot of large data files. For instance, they have planes circling the state, taking pictures, downloading these pictures, all very large data sets. So they basically had a problem, which is that many systems store data on many file servers and even locally. So they have, of course, had a naturally grown environment that became very difficult to manage, became very difficult to back up, and of course there was no disaster recovery plan. So in case of data loss, the actual company, the organization, would be stalled for a long time. Moreover, due to many historic products being used there, many processes were not very efficient. Using FTP for large file transfers, you can imagine transferring 100 gig of files over FTP between an RX box and a Windows desktop, then processing that and then putting it back, of course, is not very efficient. And, of course, with their large files, they also had performance issues because, in the end, they were transferring them way too often just between systems, sometimes even between systems of the same kind. Finally, they very heavily used local user accounts on each and every system, especially on the Unix systems. And as you might know, having local user accounts means that a new person joins your organization, sets a password, and will never change it. Because changing a password would mean they would have to change their password on maybe 10 or 20 systems, and nobody's willing to do that. So they started to think about solutions, and the solution was to make a storage consolidation project, which had been going on for more than a year before I joined this customer with this question. The reason the project was going on so long is that they couldn't really decide how to solve the problem. They've seen the problem, they've seen solutions, but they couldn't decide really how to solve the problem and how to get started. Because the financial investment required for the solutions which they wanted, of course, was significant enough to demand a certain level of reasons and paperwork to be produced to actually argue for the solution. The goals for the storage consolidation were to create a unified storage for Unix, Linux, and Windows systems. The storage has to be centralized, it has to be high available, and it has to be resilient, meaning a disaster recovery concept should be included in the storage consolidation project. Since we talk about a centralized storage, which in the end will talk to clients with file protocols, the protocol support has to be very good. There shouldn't be any protocol that doesn't work properly, there shouldn't be any protocol that works very slow. Specifically, regarding SIFS, the requirements were a decent support of Windows ACLs, access-based enumerations, in other words, you don't see what you're not allowed to see, a DFS replication, and also the support of DFS, and of course, obviously, AD integration. This organization uses Active Directory as their main user database, and any solution they purchase has to be well integrated. For NFS, they require version 2 and 3 because of their old Unix and even older machines they're still running. They require POSIX ACLs because, as any state-mandated organization, they have a very thick subset of ACLs set on really everything, because such organizations try to replicate their organizational structure within their ACL structure. It's something which private companies try to do a little bit less. And with NFS, AD integration according to RFC 2307 was mandatory, because that's what we actually already established within the Active Directory. And there was no point to have another user management scheme besides that. Furthermore, FTP async and SCP, being asynchronous protocols, also have to be supported for very special use cases that still require data transfers to dedicated systems, for instance, specialized scanners or production machines. The decision process and the criteria applied to the decision process are quite interesting, because first and foremost, there were economical and technical arguments, meaning money did play a role, and they have to argue for the money. They actually can spend money, but they have to argue for it and write a proposal defining why they need to spend this kind of money. And important criteria were actually, of course, the total cost of ownership for 3 years and the availability and reliability. For instance, they are using EVA as a storage. HP EVA is the big SAN solution from HP. And any solution that would not use the EVA should be at least as resilient and reliable as the EVA. The quality of SIFS and NFS is an important argument, and also the interoperability, meaning how well do these protocols work together on the same share, on the same storage media. Of course, the administrative overhead is important, shouldn't be too difficult, and the existing backup solution has to be well supported, which is Commvault Galaxy, something, I would say, medium Linux friendly. Could be worse, could be better. Some other criteria are the support of asynchronous protocols, which are important, but not really overly important, because for such solutions that don't have them built in, we could always use a front-end server to actually serve these protocols. And integrated replication to a secondary storage for disaster recovery purposes is a very, very nice to have thing, because it would solve the disaster recovery question, which so far they didn't have solved. Another important aspect is strengthening the future's IT strategy, with the additional problem that actually beyond 2010, nobody knows what is going to happen, because there will be a new application for the central business, map making, and nobody knows yet exactly which kind of IT requirements this application brings. So that the strategic impact of the solution is an important important criteria, because eventually the customer is reluctant at this stage to define any IT strategy going beyond 2010. Let's look at the possible solutions that we came up with, which is obviously a Windows or Linux file server, which is a NetApp FAST 3040, which is the mid-range series from NetApp, and IBM Scaleout file services, about which you will be hearing just right after me in the same place. So let's take a short look at these three solutions from the point of view of the customer, and also at the decision that in the end was made. The good thing about SOFS is, of course, it's highly redundant. It's a clustered system that doesn't have any single point of failure except the XAN storage itself. It brings a web GUI, and as an added benefit, it actually includes an ILM solution. ILM means hierarchical storage, so that you can offload old files into different storage media, even maybe tapes. And the cost is actually acceptable. It's not on the cheap side, but it's affordable for what it delivers. The problem is, of course, you have to heavily invest into IBM. And this customer actually heavily invested into HP, and HP is the set and chosen hardware vendor. So that basically going for IBM SOFS would mean that the customer would have to change his hardware strategy, which is not something done lightly. Also, using IBM SOFS, it would be impossible to use the existing storage in the EVA. And if you talk about a project with a size of 30 terabyte, such considerations do become important. So in the end, the storage strategy would have to be changed to IBM. And also, there's no internal replication to secondary storage so that the disaster recovery solution in question stays unanswered. And finally, backup is only supported with TSM internally or via SIFS or NFS externally. So that basically this solution, even though it's very nice, integrates badly into the customer environment. The NetApp, of course, is a very, very good solution. There's no doubt about that. And even me as a Linux consultant will tell you NetApp is a good solution. NetApp, however, is the most costly solution in this scenario. Again, because 30 terabyte of storage would have to be purchased again and not being used from the existing EVA. Solutions where you use NetApp with existing storage are even more costly, so they were out of the question. NetApp mostly only has good points except for the fact that the NFS ACL support is not available for version 3, which was a killing argument. And again, the long-term strategy would have to be changed to using NetApp storage as the central and basic storage solution. And again, that is something that the customer was reluctant to do because of the 2010 scope and the basically still ongoing investment into the EVA technology in-house. So that at the moment, changing the IT storage strategy away from EVA to NetApp would mean that all the investment that went into the EVA was kind of lost or wasted. So in the end, we looked at the file server question. First, of course, we looked at a Windows file server. If you do consulting, you have to be honest, so you have to look at Windows file servers too. And truth spoken, a Windows file server is not bad. It does a very good job, it's very easy to manage. Doesn't have a web GUI, but the customer is using Windows on his desktop anyway, so that isn't an issue. And backup and replication and DFS are really well supported. However, NFS is not one of Windows' strength. ACL, POSIX ACLs over NFS, of course, is nothing you should be even asking. Also, NFS is quite slow, and in the end, the customer said that they don't trust Windows with their 30 terabyte centralized file storage. Even though they're heavily Windows users, they don't trust it that much. So in the end, we talk about the Linux file server. The Linux file server has also very many good points because it's very simple. You can make it very redundant. I'll show you later why. NFS and SIFS are supported protocols, and their ACL models are as well integrated as technically possible, meaning you have POSIX ACLs as the underlying ACL model, and Windows ACLs are mapped onto that in a way which even a Windows administrator grows to understand after some time. Of course, the Linux administrator is always ready to help out with a short setfuckle call to set things right if the Windows side, again, clicked too much. Actually, the Linux file server has the richest protocol support, meaning a Linux file server can really serve any protocol spoken on Earth with modern systems, and it also supports equally well all the asynchronous protocols. Backup is no problem, it's supported. We have integrated replication to secondary storage. Of course, do it yourself, but it works very well. And best of all, no implication for the storage strategy. We use the existing EVA storage, and the server which we purchased now has no implication whatsoever for 2010. Meaning, if in 2-3 years they decide to go to NetApp, to go to IBM, to go to whatever other solution there is in the market, the money invested now will not have been lost because the money invested now will have served the company for 2 or 3 years, and that's good enough. And it is actually the cheapest solution from all the three. So it's also a very economical solution. What's not so good about Linux actually is the incomplete SIFS support, which we all know. And, well, in the end you manage it on the shell, not with a clicky, nicey, nifty GUI But again, if you like that, it's not so bad. And in this case, we have a Windows administrator who starts to use the shell on Windows for more complicated things. And we have a Linux administrator who is more than happy to take over more central services. So that actually was not a problem. In the end, we decided not simply to install a Linux file server, but to install the simple high available Linux file server. And it looks like that. The simple high available Linux file server is a file server like any other file server that has two external levels of redundancy. One level, of course, is at the machine level, meaning here's my server in hardware, giving all the performance you get from a hardware system. And it has a failover option to a virtual machine running on VMware ESX. To do that, the server, of course, should not have any local disks. This picture is a bit misleading in this case. But it should only boot from a central storage via fiber channel. This is called ZAN boot, and is something that can easily be done if you know how and if you test it well. Once you manage to do ZAN boot, it's no problem to also have a virtual machine boot from the same storage and actually give you the exactly same Linux system running on a different hardware, in this case a virtual hardware. So this is a failover solution which we call virtual cold standby servers, because you have a cold standby server that is ready to take over in case your hardware fails. But of course that wouldn't help us in case we have a storage problem. That's why, additionally, we attach an equally sized local storage via SAS to the hardware server and replicate the entire ZAN storage to the local storage, so that in the unforeseen case that the ZAN storage fails, we're able to simply reboot this server, and then, of course, it can't boot from the ZAN because the ZAN is gone, but it can boot from the locally attached storage. And then again, I get my file server with all the data from the last replication state. This is a disaster recovery solution, actually, because no matter which component, this server and this storage are the core components. Both of these core components are protected by a physically independent secondary component fulfilling the same function. The server is protected by a virtual machine, so that the customer doesn't need to buy a second server that doesn't do anything. And the storage, of course, has to be protected by another storage of equal size. It's the only way to do true disaster recovery, because any other means of disaster recovery, like let's go and restore 30 terabytes from a tape drive, of course, take way too long. And this solution doesn't have any restore time, because the data is there, it's there in a format that can be used, and the file server actually can boot from the replication storage and continue to function as a file server. Questions so far? Because that's the only picture in my presentation. Has anyone ever tried to do something like that? No? You did?
Yeah.
What did you do? Okay, but then you need network infrastructure to work it.
Yeah.
Okay.
A small question about synchronization between the two storage.
Yes.
Synchronization in
real time or? No, asynchronous. Any real time online synchronization means that you don't have true disaster recovery, because soft errors would be replicated to the disaster recovery storage, therefore rendering your disaster recovery storage unusable. So if you want to have good disaster recovery, you have to use asynchronous offline replication, which obviously gives you a certain delta between the time you lose the data and the time you jump back to of your data. Basically, the question how often you can replicate your data depends only on the amount of files which you have, on the amount of changes which happen, and the performance of your storage and your server. If you have a lot of large files, few of whom change, and you have fairly powerful resources, you can even run a replication job once an hour. It will work. In the end, you can always see whether the replication takes too much of your resources and performance and then tune it down a little bit. It's something you can easily measure. You can simply turn off replication for an hour and see whether anything significantly changes. Please. Rsync. Rsync rules. No, Rsync is the solution. It's a Linux-based solution. Mein Vortrag geht bis 9.45 Uhr. Yeah. Danke. yes, it's Rsync. And, well, I think what is new in this solution is the SANBOOT, because SANBOOT is simple, but doing it with multipathing is a problem. The components used here is hardware, all from HP, a simple file server, DL380, a nice EVA 8000, which is the upper mid-range of HP, and four MSA60 shelves, which is the locally attached storage. It's all HP commodity hardware, and of course you have to have some ESX servers to run the virtual machines on. By the way, this solution works only with VMware ESX, and basically it doesn't work well with other VMware products. And I think also with Xen, you'll find it a little bit more difficult to implement. That's related to the way how these solutions integrate the Xen storage into their virtualization environment. The software being used was SUSE Enterprise Linux SP1, standard Samba and NFS implementations. By the way, don't use the one that they ship. Use the latest Samba. And, of course, we use LVM for storage management. We use LVM snapshots with a very nifty SMB snap script to monitor and control these. Will be later more. We use Rsync for replication and, of course, a virtual machine on the VMware ESX servers, which is, of course, normally switched off. It doesn't do anything. It's only there in case the hardware fails. The challenges we had to overcome were mainly two challenges. One is Xen boot with multipathing, and we decided to use device mapper MPIO. And not the QLogic or HP or whatever MPIO. The reason to do that is that's the only one that is really supported by Novell and well supported by Novell. And the lucky thing is that SLES actually includes MPIO support in its initRD out of the box. What it doesn't support is installing a system on a multipath SANLAN. So I actually devised a method to do that with the virtual machine and the setup in the virtual machine. This is documented in a paper I published in the current iX magazine, which is a German IT magazine. And it's in German, so I'm sorry. But if anybody wants to know, just ask me. I'll tell you happily. It's not a secret. In the end, we have a dual boot system that can boot on two different types of hardware, one hardware being the real hardware from HP and the other hardware being the virtualized hardware. You have to a little bit deal with drivers and system setup. And it's always a good idea to prevent the virtual machine from booting itself if somebody who doesn't know about the solution switches it on. So we simply made up a little ISO image that would put up a nice splash screen. Don't boot this machine unless you know what you're doing. You'll be guilty. To warn off everybody who's playing with that. The other challenge is managing the local storage. And managing the local storage means, of course, devising an automated way of cloning the Xen storage to the local storage. And we wanted to do it so that each of the MSA60 shelf, which holds about a little bit over 8 terabyte, would be able to work independently from the others. The idea is that in the case of a longer-lasting disaster, we would be able to split the four shelves into four different servers that would be able to work independently. Of course, each data share on this server would thus be limited to 8 terabyte, but that's fine for this customer. And the solution to do that was to define a RAID 1 boot volume on all the four LANs I get from these shelves. And thus, I'm able to take any shelf out, connect it to a server, switch on the server, it would boot from that. But the software RAID takes care for the data replication between the four shelves. And, of course, I have to write a script that replicates the system from the Xen to the local storage and maybe makes a few modifications so that the system would mount the local storage instead of the Xant storage and so on. In the end, of course, we have a nightly rsync of all data from Xant to local storage. I think everybody knows rsync. It's no secret. It's simple. The only thing we had to do here was to make sure that rsync wouldn't accidentally fill up the root volume if the destination was not mounted or something like that. So I wrote a little script that would check that the source and the destination of the rsync are actually mounted partitions, separate file systems from the root file system, so that there would not be any chance for any accident. The benefits of this solution are, of course, two dimensions of redundancy. I have the upper level of redundancy between the hardware and the virtual machine, and I have the storage redundancy between my production Xant storage, which, by the way, is quite high performance, and the local storage, which is not so much high performance, but still works well. And in the end, I get recovery times in the order of magnitude of 5 minutes after the administrator pays attention and wakes up, maybe, to solve any problem there, because all the problems can be solved by booting something, either booting the virtual machine or rebooting the hardware, and that's it. And that's what makes it so simple, because even the other administrator who was not involved in the project can do that, can go switch off the hardware, switch on the virtual machine, and that's it. That's why it's a very, very simple system that still gives you the highest possible level of availability within the given framework. Of course, it's not as high available as an online cluster, but this system does not have the drawbacks of an online cluster. There's no clusterware that could really shoot itself in the head and decide that it's not fit to work anymore. There's nothing there that could somehow go wrong, because basically I always have a simple file server. Simple meaning one box, no connections to the outside, no relations with the outside. And I simply have several ways of running this single file server. Eventually, the administrator carries the full responsibility, which is good for me as the consultant, because he can't blame me for the system doing something, and was also quite acceptable for the customer, because they don't have 24/7 operations, and therefore, they don't really need an automated failover at night. It's enough if in the morning somebody comes and notices that there's a problem and solves the problem. What, of course, makes this solution very attractive is the fact that you get an affordable solution with no extra cost for high availability. It's free. There's no cost for high availability at all. Maybe some words about the technical setup used. If you have a local storage that is larger than 2 terabyte, your FDisk will not work anymore. So you have to use the GPT partitioning scheme, and then you're able to set up a large partition spanning 8 terabyte. Very funny, and something that you probably don't study in the average Linux course. The system has to be on RAID 1. It has to boot from RAID 1. So we're using LILO, which very nicely handles GPT and boot from RAID. Everything is LVM, logical volume management. And this is really useful because, first of all, it gives you names for everything, meaning each piece of storage has a name. Each LUN, in the end, has a name, and each partition has a name, and you don't start to think, okay, SDD5, where does it belong? So please use LVM to have proper names for everything. Rsync with sanity checks is a script that I will be happy to send you by email if you need something like that, but I can also recommend it as a little exercise in shell scripting. It's about this long and took 30 minutes to write. But you shouldn't do any rsync without sanity checks, because rsync will happily fill up your root file system with a lot of files from somewhere else. So if you don't do these sanity checks, you really produce a very high risk in this place. Some words about Samba. AD integration is done over RFC 2307, which I think is by now fairly well documented. Here's a little excerpt from our Samba configuration, and you see that it's not really much out of the usual. We switched to DDBSAM, which is something you should do by default because it's the only one that supports all features. We use SMB ports to disable all the old junk. We disable NetBIOS, again, old junk. And we use only WINS, again, no old junk, please. Very important to inherit ACLs, otherwise you won't may really satisfy your Windows administrators. And hide unreadable is this access-based enumeration thing which they all dream about since Windows came up with the idea. You see the ID map backend, AD, the UID and git ranges, and finally, WinBind NSS info is the important thing you have to remember. Use SendFile, by the way, is very useful to speed up certain kind of transfers. And finally, please remember to map the built-in accounts. Built-in accounts are the accounts with the very funny SID that doesn't belong anywhere. And if you don't do that, then under Windows, you won't really see all the ACLs correctly. Because usually you map the built-in accounts to some standard Unix groups like wheel, nobody, and users. And you map that to administrators, guests, and users again. And then you have a very nicely integrated system. Of course, with a central file server, you talk about performance tuning. And actually, the biggest effect on the performance we found by setting these syscontrol conf parameters. These really had the biggest effect. And together with setting an appropriate number of kernel NFS daemons, we were able to achieve a fairly well performance, which approaches the gigabit wire speed, especially with NFS. With SIVs, there is an inherent performance bottleneck, which is the way how SIVs reads and writes, meaning it sends a packet and waits for the answer, and then it sends the next packet. So you easily get high SIVs performance with several streams, or for instance, IO meter and using the setting that it should use several outstanding IO requests. Otherwise, your SIVs performance from a single client will be capped at about 65, 75 megabyte per second. And by the way, you can observe that also between two Windows machines. We're using XFS, which works well on SLES. Don't use it on Red Hat. It showed the best performance and really was faster than X3. But even if the XFS breaks, we have a disaster recovery backup. So we feel fairly safe. And of course, you use bonding. And by the way, jumbo frames, which took us a lot of time to test, had no real significant effect on the throughput, though it had a measurable effect on reducing CPU usage. So we decided not to set up a jumbo frame network because of the real overhead incurred in all the house and all the environment. But it might be something we'll be doing next year when they start to have very large, heavy transfers from a few stations. Then maybe we set up a secondary network for jumbo frames. In the end, that's it. It shows, again, Linux gives good performance without really working hard, which is very nice. And of course, there's an outlook, what to do next. The system at the moment has no automated failover, which is something we might be implementing with the next release of SUSE Linux Enterprise, which will bring a modularized initRD that will make it fairly simple to plug some kind of heartbeat mechanism, I'm not talking about the heartbeat suite, into the initRD to occur before mounting the root file system. And that would allow the standby machine, whichever that will be, to actually be booted and wait in the initRD till the production machine fails for, let's say, 15 or 20 minutes, and then it would simply continue to boot up. And that's a way to automate the failover again without really having a cluster. The other thing we would like to automate is monitoring the storage and the network, and this is a little bit difficult because you easily monitor too much or too little, and it's very difficult to really make the right decision when you monitor these resources because you never know whether the other system will actually have better access or not. In the end, you can only say, well, I'm not feeling well, I go down, let the other one come up, maybe there it will be better, but there's no guarantee for that. Another thing we might be looking into is MD or LVM mirroring between the two storages. Of course, it's not good for disaster recovery, but maybe we'll be doing it for some areas, for some LUNs, to have real-time disaster recovery with the risk of soft errors. And of course, it would be interesting to see multipathing Xen boot also with other Linux distributions than SUSE. But as far as I can see, it won't be that simple. And you will have to patch your initRD heavily because the distribution doesn't do it for you. And eventually, the idea of virtualized cold standby systems can be used for any and all hardware server. It's not limited to Linux. It works on Windows. We tested it. And it's simply an idea how not to buy hardware that you don't need. And standby hardware is hardware that you don't need. Because if your production hardware fails, you will never mind any kind of performance impact due to the virtualization. You'll just be happy that instead of having 100 standby servers, you have one ESX server for them all. And that's a fair deal. As you can see, the whole thing I'm presenting you is mostly an idea and a way of thinking. It's not really a difficult technical solution. I think everybody can implement it themselves. If you have any questions about the implementation details, please feel free to send me an email and I'll be happy to help you. And finally, questions and answers. Please also do take a look at my other open source projects. Maybe one of you would be happy to visit us at Linux Talk, where we will have a booth for Relax and Recover. And open source means giving away and sharing and talking about it. So if anybody finds a bug, please let me know. I like bugs. Thank you very much. We're open now for questions, and I think I'm still on time. So, please. The question was, what's the performance impact running on a virtual machine? And this, of course, heavily depends on the question of which virtualization technology they use. With VMware ESX, you have a performance impact of something between 10 and 0%, meaning with a virtual machine, we also get 1 gigabit wire speed over the network, which without any problem, and we get sufficient storage speed to feed the wire speed file transfer. So yes, that would be sufficient for me. Of course, if you run a hard disk benchmark, it will be slower in the virtual machine. But when you talk about virtualization, you stop to talk about top performance and start to talk about necessary performance. And the answer is yes, all virtual machines and all virtualized environments provide the required and necessary performance to run IT systems. And that's enough. Why not always run on a virtual machine? Okay, good question. The answer is that the scalability of the performance is still better on hardware. Meaning, you can easily plug 4 or even more 1 gigabit links into this single file server and get the aggregate performance out of it. You'll find it very difficult to get this kind of aggregate performance out of a virtual machine. And since this is going to be the centralized file server for a lot of data and all the clients, the customer decided that this is worth the investment into a hardware server. But, you know, in the end, the hardware server costs something like 6,000 euro. And that's not a big deal. Because the other option was something like 200,000 euro for the NetApp. Okay, any other questions? Please. I didn't mention it, the file server has 32 gig of memory, which is kind of standard for ESX servers, so the customer decided, well, I'll just buy another ESX server and use it as a file server. Why not? RAM's not that expensive, and once the customers get used to buying ESX servers, they also get used to buy regular servers with more memory. But you're right, rsync has a very high dependency on memory, and it will blow your system if you don't have enough of that. Yes, definitely. But by the way, if you run a Samba server with a lot of users, you shouldn't be really trying to do it with very low memory, because also Samba uses a lot of memory. Because Samba allocates memory per connection and per user, and this can easily add up to several gigabytes. Well, please look into your environment and look where and whether you can make use of the virtualized standby server idea. If you live in Germany, buy the IX magazine. It has a very clear and detailed description of how to do that. I don't get any royalties. I already got my royalty for the article. But still, it's a good magazine. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. So, thank you very much. I'll be at the conference till 4 o'clock today. And also, if anyone has questions about virtualization and Samba, please feel free to ask me. Thank you.